Chapter 14 Counter-Revolution of Property. How, after the war, triumphant industry in the North, coupled with privilege and monopoly, led an orgy of theft that engulfed the nation and was the natural child of war, and how revolt against this anarchy became reaction against democracy, North and South, and delivered the land into the hands of an organized monarchy of finance, while it overthrew the attempt at a dictatorship of labor in the South. The abolition democracy of the North had been willing to try real democracy in the South because they believed in the capabilities of the Negro race, and also because they had passed through war, oligarchy, and the almost unbridled power of Andrew Johnson. Relatively few of them believed in the mass of Negroes any more than they believed in the mass of whites, but they expected that with education, economic opportunity, and the protection of the ballot, there would arise the intelligent and thrifty Negro to take his part in the community, while the mass would make average labor. Perhaps they did not expect the proportion of thrift and intelligence to equal that of the whites, but they knew certain possibilities from experience and acquaintance. The machinery they were compelled to set up, with the cooperation of Northern industry, was a dictatorship of far broader possibilities than the North had at first contemplated. It put such power in the hands of Southern labor that, with intelligent and unselfish leadership and a clarifying ideal, it could have rebuilt the economic foundations of Southern society, confiscated and redistributed wealth, and built a real democracy of industry for the masses of men. When the South realized this, they emitted an exceeding great cry, which was the reaction of property being despoiled of its legal basis of being. This bitter complaint was all the more plausible because Southern labor lacked sufficient intelligent and unselfish leadership. Some, in truth, it got from black men who gave their hearts' blood to make Reconstruction go, from white men who sacrificed everything to teach and guide Negroes. But for the most part, their leaders were colored men of limited education, with the current honesty of the times, and little experience. And Northern and Southern whites, who varied from conventional and indifferent office holders to demagogues, thieves, and scoundrels. The next step would have been, under law and order, gradually to have replaced the wrong leaders by a better and better sort. This the Negroes and many whites sought to do from 1870 to 1876, but they failed, because the military dictatorship behind labor did not function successfully in the face of the Ku Klux Klan, and especially because the appeal of property in the South got the ear of property in the North. After the war, industry in the North found itself with a vast organization for production, new supplies of raw material, a growing transportation system on land and water, and a new technical knowledge of processes. All this, with the exclusion of foreign competition through a system of import taxes and a vast immigration of laborers, tremendously stimulated the production of goods and available services. But to whom were the new goods and the increased services to belong, and in whose hands would lie the power which that ownership gave? An almost unprecedented scramble for this new power, new wealth, and new income ensued. It broke down old standards of wealth distribution, old standards of thrift and honesty. It led to the anarchy of thieves, grafters, and highwaymen. It threatened the orderly processes of production, as well as government and morals. The governments, federal, state, and local, had paid 3/5 of the cost of the railroads and handed them over to individuals and corporations to use for their profit. An empire of rich land, larger than France, Belgium and Holland together, had been snatched from the hands of prospective peasant farmers and given to investors and land speculators. All of the national treasure of coal, oil, copper, gold, and iron had been given away for a song to be made the monopolized basis of private fortunes with perpetual power to tax labor for the right to live and work. Speculation rose and flourished on the hard foundation of this largesse. Senator George Hoar said, "When the greatest railroad of the world, binding together the continent and uniting the two great seas which wash our shores, was finished, I have seen our national triumph and exaltation turned to bitterness and shame by the unanimous reports of 3 committees of Congress that every step of that mighty enterprise had been taken in fraud." William N. Tweed, became New York State Senator in 1868, and his candidates for governor and mayor were swept into office that year. Tweed became director in numbers of great corporations and regularly bribed the legislature. Graft crept into all city business. He and his partners stole something like $75 million. Public opinion was silenced. Real estate owners, merchants, and the propertied class were afraid to complain lest they be highly assessed and taxed. Offices were sold, and men nominated for what they could pay. Directors and corporations plotted and nominated judges. Men were sent to the United States Senate because they were lawyers for railroads, mining companies, and banks. Congressional leaders were on the payrolls of corporations. Great lawyers hired their services to rascals who were stealing, and such persons included distinguished names like David Dudley Field, who was nearly expelled from the Bar Association because of his identification with Fisk, and Gould, at a salary of $125,000. Editors of publications received stocks and bonds and railroad passes for publicity. Appointment to cadetships at West Point was on sale, and federal offices given in return for contributions to campaign funds. The whole civil service became filled with men who were incompetent and used to paying political debts. It was common for members of Congress to take stocks and bonds in railroad and other companies when they were in position to favor these companies by voting for certain laws. A Western governor was impeached for embezzlement. The President of the United States and his family received gifts and loans from financiers. Consolidation of railroad systems began with fighting, stealing, and cheating. The New York Central was financed. The Erie went through an extraordinary series of manipulations in which millions were spent. Judges were bought, and members of the legislature were bribed. The new method of stock watering came into use by which actual invested capital was doubled and trebled in face value by issuing stock, and the public was compelled to pay fabulous interest on fictitious investments. When the annals of this republic show the disgrace and censure of a vice president, a late Speaker of the House of Representatives marketing his rulings as a presiding officer, three senators profiting secretly by their votes as lawmakers, five chairmen of the leading committees of the late House of Representatives exposed in jobbery, a late Secretary of the Treasury forcing balances in the public accounts, a late Attorney General misappropriating public funds, a Secretary of the Navy enriched or enriching friends by percentages levied off the profits of contracts with his departments, an ambassador to England censured in a dishonorable speculation, the President's private secretary barely escaping conviction upon trial for guilty complicity in frauds upon the revenue, a Secretary of War impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. The demonstration is complete. All this was not simply the corruption of the Republican Party, as some writers insist. It ran across all lines of party and geography. It embraced all sections, classes, and races. It was the disgrace of a whole nation. The slime of this era of theft and corruption, which engulfed the nation, did not pass by the South. Legislatures and public officials were bribed. Black men and white men were eager to get rich. In every Southern state, white members of the old planting aristocracy were part and parcel of the new thieving and grafting. But the South did not lay the blame of all this on war and poverty and weak human nature, or on the wretched example of the whole nation. No. After first blaming greedy and vengeful Northerners, and then holding up to public execration those Southerners who accepted Negro suffrage, the South, finally, with almost complete unity, named the Negro as the main cause of Southern corruption. They said and reiterated this charge until it became history, that the cause of dishonesty during Reconstruction was the fact that 4 million disfranchised black laborers, after 250 years of exploitation, had been given a legal right to have some voice in their own government, in the kinds of goods they would make, and the sort of work they would do, and in the distribution of the wealth which they created. Throughout the North, reaction followed, directed mainly at two impossible goals. First, to reestablish old standards of honesty in a new field. Property was taking new forms and called for a new morality, not a reestablishment of the old. Secondly, an attempt was made to curb production by breaking down tariff walls, the monopoly of raw materials, and the privileges of special laws and exclusive techniques. But this was also difficult, if not impossible, so long as the rewards of monopoly and privilege were so spectacular and the powers bestowed so tremendous. Thus, the old dictatorship carried on by property interests failed, while at the same time a new super-dictatorship arose. The dictatorship of property, as represented by the wild freebooting from the close of the war to the panic, had proven to many minds that free competition in industry was not going to bring proper control and development. Far from turning toward any conception of dictatorship of the proletariat, of surrendering power either into the hands of labor or of the trustees of labor, the new plan was to concentrate into a trusteeship of capital, a new and far-reaching power, which would dominate the government of the United States. This was not a petty bourgeois development, following the overthrow of agrarian feudalism in the South. It was, on the contrary, a new feudalism based on monopoly, but not monopoly of the agricultural possibilities of the land so much as of its wealth in raw material, in copper, iron, oil, and coal, particularly monopoly of the transportation of these commodities on new public iron roads privately sequestered, and finally of the manufacture of goods by new machines and privileged technique. This new feudalism was destined to crush the small capitalist as ruthlessly as it controlled labor, and even before the panic of 1873, it was beginning to consolidate its power. The copper of Michigan, the coal, steel, and oil of Pennsylvania came under control, and at the same time, the bankers and financiers began to bend the manufacturers and the railroads to their will by their monopoly of investment capital and direction of its distribution, which they secured by guaranteeing income to small investors. Great corporations, through their control of new capital, began to establish a super-government. On the one hand, they crushed the robber barons, the thieves, and the grafters, and thus appeased those of the old school who demanded the old standards of personal honesty. Secondly, they made treaty with the petty bourgeoisie, by guaranteeing them reasonable and certain income from their investments, while they gradually deprived them of real control in industry. And finally, they made treaty with labor by dealing with it as a powerful, determined unit and dividing it up into skilled union labor, with which the new industry shared profit in the shape of a higher wage and other privileges, and a great reservoir of common and foreign labor, which it kept at work at low wages with the threat of starvation and with police control. This control of supercapital and big business was being developed during the 10 years of Southern Reconstruction and was dependent and consequent upon the failure of democracy in the South, just as it fattened upon the perversion of democracy in the North. And when once the control of industry by big business was certain through consolidation and manipulation, that included both North and South, big business shamelessly deserted, not only the Negro, but the cause of democracy, not only in the South, but in the North. To the leaders of the Republican Revolt of 1872, big business offered law and order, greater efficiency of the businessman in politics, and security of salaries and investment. To the insurgent West, it offered combinations which would give lower railway rates, wider and better markets, and rising land values. To the South, it offered the withdrawal of the National Army and the restoration of political control to property. Before this dominant power, the meaning of party designations faded. When the old Democratic Party secured a majority in Congress in 1874, the majority sat under the dictatorship of big business. When the Republicans were seated in 1876, the empire of industry was completed. To the student of government, who fastens his attention chiefly on politics, the years 1866 to 1876 were years when the power of the national government remained exclusively democratic, with ultimate control in the hands of the mass of citizens who had the right to vote. But the student who realizes that human activity is chiefly exercised in earning a living, and thus particularly in the present industrial age, the actions of groups and governments have to do mainly with income, This student will see that the Civil War brought anarchy in the basic economic activities which were gradually hammered and forced into a new and vast monarchy of tremendous power, an almost miraculous accomplishment. Forms of democratic government went on, but they were almost fantastic in their travesty on real popular control. Industrial freebooters and bandits, now as lone and picturesque masked highwaymen, now hunting in packs and mercenary armies, gripped and guided the efforts of a vast nation to get rich after the indiscriminate murder and destruction of 4 years' war. All this led to disaster, which threatened the industrial machine. Those who still believed in democracy came to the rescue and saw salvation, in the North as in the South, in universal suffrage. In the South, universal suffrage could not function without personal freedom, land, and education. And until these institutions were real and effective, only a benevolent dictatorship in the ultimate interests of labor, black and white, could establish democracy. In the North, democracy ceased to function because of corruption and bribery, the open buying of elections, low and selfish ideals, and officials chosen to misgovern in the interest of industrial freebooters. The party of democracy saw salvation in increased freedom of industrial competition through the uprooting of tariff-nurtured monopoly and civil service reform, which would replace knavery and selfishness by character and ideal in public office. Then, with an electorate of growing intelligence, democracy would truly function. But the electorate, despite schools and churches, was not intelligent. It was provincial and bigoted, thinned by poverty-stricken and ignorant peasant laborers from abroad, and impregnated with the idea that individual wealth spelled national prosperity, and particularly with the American assumption of equal economic opportunity for all, which persisted in the face of facts. Only a vast and single-eyed dictatorship of the nation could guide us up from murder in the South and robbery and cheating in the North into a nation whose infinite resources would be developed in the interest of the mass of the nation, that is, of the laboring poor. Dictatorship came, and it came to guide the industrial development of the nation by an assumption of irresponsible monarchical power such as enthroned the Caesars, by methods of efficiency of accomplishment and control never surpassed among so many millions of men. But the object of this new American industrial empire, so far as that object was conscious and normative, was not national well-being, but the individual gain of the associated and corporate monarchs through the power of vast profit on enormous capital investment. Through the efficiency of an industrial machine that brought the highest managerial and engineering talent and used the latest and most effective methods and machines in a field of unequaled raw material and endless market demand. That this machine might use the profit for the general weal was possible, and in most cases true. But the uplift and well-being of the mass of men, of the cohorts of common labor, was not its ideal or excuse. Profit, income, uncontrolled power in my business for my property and for me. This was the aim and method of the new monarchical dictatorship that displaced democracy in the United States in 1876. Part and parcel of this system was the emancipated South. Property control, especially of land and labor, had always dominated politics in the South, and after the war, it set itself to put labor to work at a wage approximating as nearly as possible slavery conditions in order to restore capital lost in the war. On the other hand, labor was in open revolt by army desertions, by the general strike and arming of black labor, by government employment through the army and the Freedmen's Bureau. But its revolt could only be shown by refusal to work under the old conditions, and it had neither permanent organization nor savings to sustain it in such a fight. Into this situation, Northern capital projected itself through the agency of the so-called carpetbagger. The carpetbagger tried to stimulate production on the Northern model. He offered the laborer higher wages and yielded him political power. He tried to establish wide systems of transportation and to exploit new raw materials. His efforts involved the same overthrow of old standards of honesty and integrity prevalent in the North, and this was emphasized in the South by the post-war bitterness and war losses of capital. The orgy of graft, dishonesty, and theft, North and South, was of the same pattern and involved the same sorts of people. Those scrambling to share in the distribution of new goods and services which the new industry in the North and the restoration of the old agriculture in the South poured out, and those trying to get legal titles to the new forms of property and income which were arising. The South, however, had two peculiar elements: a capitalist class, deprived of most of its capital except land, and a new class of free black labor with the right to vote. Into the hands of this body of labor, the North had been compelled by the intransigeance of the planters themselves to place a tremendous dictatorship, and this dictatorship of labor was gradually being set to change the whole pattern of distribution of wealth. But Southern labor was thinking in terms of land and crops and the old forms of wealth, and was but dimly conscious of the new industry and the new wealth. The landholder, therefore, in the South was caught in a curious vice. Impoverished by the war, he found labor in control of the remaining parts of his wealth and determined to distribute it for the uplift of the mass of men. He found carpetbaggers encouraging this by yielding to the political power of laborers and manipulating that power so as to put into the hands of carpetbaggers the new wealth arising from corporations, railroads, and industries. He found the carpetbagger trying to raise the capital necessary for new investment through spending money borrowed by the state, and thus increasing the taxation on him, which already new social legislation on behalf of the laborers had increased. The result was that a scramble ensued in the South as mad as that in the North, but different, more fundamental, more primitive. It had been insistently and firmly believed by the best thought of the South: 1. That the Negro could not work as a free laborer; that the Negro could not really be educated, being congenitally inferior; 3. That if political power were given to Negroes, it would result virtually in the overthrow of civilization. Now, it is quite clear that during the period we are studying, the results failed to prove these assumptions. First of all, the Negro did work as a free laborer. Slowly but certainly, the tremendous losses brought on by the Civil War were restored, and restoration, as compared with other great wars, was comparatively rapid. By 1870, the Cotton Kingdom was reestablished. And by 1875, the South knew that with cheap labor and freedom from government control, it was possible for individuals to reap large profit in the old agriculture and in new industry. The restoration of Southern industry varied according to crops and conditions. The cotton crop, for instance, which was 2,469,093 in 1850 and leaped to the high mark of 5,387,052 in 1860, dropped to 3,011,996 in 1870, but had surpassed by 1880 the high mark of 1860 by reaching 5,755,359 bales, and then went on to 10, 12, and 14 million bales. The sugar production did not recover as quickly, but its decline began before the war. There were 247 million pounds raised in 1850, 230 million in 1860, and only 87 million in 1870. But by 1880, it had reached 178 million, and from then kept on its path of recovery. Tobacco was at 434 million pounds in 1860 and 472 million pounds in 1880. The production of corn had recovered by 1880, and the average value of livestock on farms had very nearly recovered by 1870. The production of wool in the South did not greatly decline and had rapidly recovered by 1880. Rice continued a decline begun before the war from 215 million pounds in 1850 to 178 million in 1860. 73 million in 1870, and up to 110 million in 1880. It is true that after the war, a larger and larger proportion of white laborers were in part responsible for the increased crops. But this simply proved that emancipating one class of laborers emancipated all and was to the credit of abolition. Nevertheless, the free black laborer was the main constituent labor force in the South and, as such, largely responsible for results. The land holdings in the South decreased, showing a tendency toward peasant proprietorship. The average acreage of 335 acres in 1860 fell to 214 acres in 1870 and 153 acres in 1880. The increase in the value of machinery and implements per acre, while not as great, showed gradual progress. The average value of farmland did not recover from its high speculative value of 1860 until 30 years later, but on the other hand, its decrease in value, 1860 to 1870, was not large. The land, for instance, in 1870 in the South was worth more in average value per acre, including improvements and livestock, than in 1850. The testimony of unprejudiced visitors as to the work of the Negro as a free laborer during these days is practically unanimous. Nordhoff said in 1875, "The Negro, in the main, is industrious. Free labor is an undoubted success in the South. The Negro works. He raises cotton and corn, sugar and rice, and it is infinitely to his credit that he continues to do so and, according to universal testimony, works more steadfastly and effectively this year than ever before since 1865, in spite of the political hurly-burly in which he has lived for the last 10 years. Summers said, "The testimony generally borne to the Negro is that they work readily when regularly paid. Wherever I have consulted an effective employer, whether in the manufacturing works of Richmond or on the farms and plantations, such is the opinion with little variation that has been given." The testimony borne to the Negroes by candid and substantial people is that while they do not afford the supply of steady labor necessary, and there is room for more of them, or of more efficient laborers, they are doing much better than was expected before emancipation. That the Negroes are improving, and many of them rising under freedom into a very comfortable and civilized condition, is not only admitted in all the upper circles of society, but would strike even a transient wayfarer like myself in the great number of decent colored men of the laboring class and of happy colored families that one meets. Manufacturers began to develop in the South. The manufacture of pig iron assumed importance in Alabama in 1874, and the output arose from 64,000 to 1,405,000 in 1875. The manufacture of cotton goods increased in North and South Carolina. The number of mills in South Carolina was 270 in 1860 and 720 in 1880. The railroad mileage southeast of the Mississippi was 8,838 miles in 1860 and 11,501 in 1870. West of the Mississippi, the growth was even larger. In every southern state, 1860 to 1866, the railroad mileage increased, sometimes only slightly, as from 973 to 1,007 in South Carolina and from 1,420 to 1,502 in Georgia. But all these figures include the rebuilding of railroads destroyed during the war. White labor was of increased importance in these lines, but colored labor was never negligible. With regard to education, the testimony is equally clear. Grant that the Negro began as almost totally illiterate, the increase in schools and education, largely by his own initiative, is one of the most extraordinary developments of modern days, and will be treated more in detail in the next chapter. It is enough to say here that the question as to whether American Negroes were capable of education was no longer a debatable one in 1876. The whole problem was simply one of opportunity. The third problem, one of the Negro's use of his political power, was not so clear because it involved matters of norm and ideal. Whose civilization, whose culture, whose comfort was involved? The Negro certainly did not attempt to overthrow civilization in the sense of attacking the fundamental morals and habits of modern life. Sir George Campbell said in 1879, "During the last dozen years, the Negroes have had a very large share of political education. Considering the troubles and the ups and downs that they have gone through, it is, I think, wonderful how beneficial this education has been to them, and how much these people, so lately in the most debased condition of slavery, have acquired independent ideas, and, far from lapsing into anarchy, have become citizens with ideas of law and property and order. The white serfs of European countries took hundreds of years to rise to the level which these Negroes adopted in America." Before I went south, I certainly expected to find that the southern states had been for a time a sort of pandemonium in which a white man could hardly live. Yet it certainly was not so. When I went to South Carolina, I thought there at least I must find great social disturbances. And in South Carolina, I went to the county of Beaufort, the blackest part of the state in point of population, and that in which black rule has been most complete and has lasted longest. It has the reputation of being a sort of black paradise, and, per contra, I rather expected a sort of white hell. There, I thought I should see a rough Liberia, where blacks ruled roughshod over the whites. To my great surprise, I found exactly the contrary. At no place that I have seen are the relations of the two races better and more peaceable. All the best houses are in the occupation of the whites, almost all the trades, professions, and leading occupations. White girls go about freely and pleasantly, as if no black had ever been in power. Here, the blacks still control the elections and send their representatives to the state assembly. In Mississippi alone did I find politicians silly enough to talk about the superiority of the Caucasian race and the natural incapacity of the Negro for self-government. But even there, the best Republicans told that these noisy Democratic demagogues were but a small, though aggressive, and not unpowerful minority. Sir George Campbell, however, makes one interesting observation. Not only is the Negro labor excellent, but also there is among the Southern proprietors and leading men accustomed to black labor and not so used to whites, a disposition greatly to rely on black labor as a conservative element, securing them against the dangers and difficulties which they see arising from the combinations and violence of the white laborers in some of the northern states. And on this ground, the blacks are cherished and protected by Democratic statesmen and now hold power in the South. If we include, in morals and culture, the prevailing manner of holding and distributing wealth, then the sudden enfranchisement of a mass of laborers threatens fundamental and far-reaching change, no matter what their race or color. It was this that the South feared and had reason to fear. Economic revolution did not come immediately. Negro labor was ignorant, docile, and conservative. But it was beginning to learn. It was beginning to assert itself. It was beginning to have radical thoughts as to the distribution of land and wealth. If now it is true that the enfranchisement of black labor in the South did not crush industry, but gave the South a working class capable of being trained in intelligence and did not disturb the essential basis of civilization, what is the indictment? The bitter and deep-seated indictment brought against the Negro voter. The indictment rests upon this unquestioned fact. Property in the South had its value cut in half during the Civil War. This meant that property was compelled after the war not simply to attempt to restore its losses, but to bear a burden of social expense, largely because of the widened duties of the state and the greatly increased citizenship due to emancipation and enfranchisement. The bitter conflict, therefore, which followed the enfranchisement of Negro labor and of white labor, came because impoverished property holders were compelled by the votes of poor men to bear a burden which meant practically confiscation of much of that property which remained to them, and were denied opportunity to exploit labor in the future as they had in the past. It was not, then, that the postbellum South could not produce wealth with free labor. It was the far more fundamental question as to whom this wealth was to belong to and for whose interests laborers were to work. There is no doubt that the object of the black and white labor vote was gradually conceived as one which involved confiscating the property of the rich. This was a program that could not be openly avowed by intelligent men in 1870, but it has become one of the acknowledged functions of the state in 1933, and it is quite possible that long before the end of the 20th century, the deliberate distribution of property and income by the state on an equitable and logical basis will be looked upon as the state's prime function. Put all these facts together, and one gets a clear idea not of the failure of Negro suffrage in the South, but of the basic difficulty which it encountered, and the results are quite consistent with a clear judgment that Negro and white labor ought to have had the right to vote, that they ought to have tried to change the basis of property and redistribute income, and that their failure to do this was a disaster to democratic government in the United States. To men like Charles Sumner, the future of democracy in America depended on bringing the Southern Revolution to a successful close by accomplishing two things: the making of the black freedmen really free, and the sweeping away of the animosities due to the war. What liberalism did not understand was that such a revolution was economic and involved force. Those who against the public weal have power cannot be expected to yield save to superior power. The North used its power in the Civil War to break the political power of the slave barons. During and after the war, it united its force with that of the workers to uproot the still vast economic power of the planters. It hoped with the high humanitarianism of Charles Sumner eventually to induce the planter to surrender his economic power peacefully in return for complete political amnesty, and hoped that the North would use its federal police power to maintain the black man's civil rights in return for peaceful industry and increasing intelligence. But Charles Sumner did not realize, and that other Charles, Karl Marx, had not yet published Das Kapital to prove to men that economic power underlies politics. Abolitionists failed to see that after the momentary exaltation of war, the nation did not want Negroes to have civil rights, and that national industry could get its way easier by alliance with Southern landholders than by sustaining Southern workers. They did not know that when they let the dictatorship of labor be overthrown in the South, they surrendered the hope of democracy in America for all men. Doggedly to the end of his days and with his dying breath, Charles Sumner strove for his peaceful revolutionary ideal. As early as 1870, he had tried to have the names of Civil War battles taken from the Army Register and the regimental colors. He introduced the matter in Congress again in 1872. He was unsuccessful, and not only that, he was publicly censored by his own Massachusetts legislature. When Congress met in the fall of 1871, Sumner made his last effort to carry his civil rights bill. The first civil rights bill of April 9, 1866, after varied experience in the courts, was superseded by the first section of the 14th Amendment. The present bill was aimed at the North, as well as the South, and Sumner proposed to secure equality of civil rights to colored people and prohibit discrimination against them in railroads, theaters, hotels, schools, cemeteries, and churches, and in serving as jurors. He presented a series of petitions favoring the bill and tried to make action on the bill a condition of adjournment. Finally, he sought to make the pressure for reconciliation with the South a part of his movement for civil rights. He therefore moved his civil rights bill as an amendment to the amnesty bill, which had been passed in the House. He thought the two measures should be associated in history, the one an act of justice and the other an act of generosity, and it was his opinion, not, however, justified by the result, that the desire for amnesty was so strong that when once his civil rights measure had been incorporated in it, the bill thus amended would pass by a two-thirds vote. His amendment was lost in committee of the whole by a single vote, and moving it again after the bill was reported, he said, "I entreat senators over the way, the Democrats, who really seek reconciliation, now to unite in this honest effort. Give me an opportunity to vote for this bill. I long to do it. Gladly would I reach out the olive branch, but I know no way in which that can be done unless you begin by justice to the colored race." Colored people held meetings to popularize the measure, but there was no wide interest in it. After the Christmas recess, Sumner made his final appeal. "I make this appeal also for the sake of peace, so that at last there shall be an end of slavery, and the rights of the citizen shall be everywhere under the equal safeguard of national law. There is beauty in art, in literature, in science, and in every triumph of intelligence, all of which I covet for my country. But there is a higher beauty still, in relieving the poor, in elevating the downtrodden, and being a succor to the oppressed. There is true grandeur in an example of justice, making the rights of all the same as our own, and beating down prejudice, like Satan, under our feet. Humbly do I pray that the Republic may not lose this great prize, or postpone its enjoyment. He read documents, letters, and newspaper extracts to show the necessity for the bill. The galleries were filled with colored people, but industry and the new finance looked askance. Their attitude toward the abolition democracy was plainly expressed in 1876 by Henry Cook, brother of Jay Cook, the great banker. "You know how I have felt for a long time in regard to the course of the ultra-infidelic radicals like Wade, Sumner, Stevens, et id omne genus. They were dragging the Republican Party into all sorts of isms and extremes. Their policy was one of bitterness, hate, and wild agrarianism. These reckless demagogues have had their day, and the time has come for wiser counsel." With Wade uttering agrarian doctrines in Kansas and fanning the flames of vulgar prejudices, trying to array labor against capital and pandering to the basest passions, with Butler urging wholesale conscription throughout the South and wholesale repudiation throughout the North, with Stevens advocating the idea of a flood of irredeemable paper money, with Pomeroy and Wade and Sprague and a host of others clamoring for the unsexing of woman, the load was too heavy for any party to carry. Even Schurz did not sympathize with Sumner and said little during the debate. Sumner pushed the bill throughout the session, but despite his efforts, the bill failed. Another bill came from the House 3 months later, but was lost by a Senate vote. Just after that, Sumner again sought to attach his civil rights proviso to the amnesty bill. He lost in the committee of the whole by a single vote. He placed the civil rights bill on the calendar with the amnesty bill, but his strategy was finally defeated by a ruse, and the amnesty bill passed without the civil rights bill. On the first day of the new Congress, December 1873, Sumner pressed two measures, a national civil rights bill and a bill for equal rights in the schools of the District of Columbia. He traced, in debate, the history of the Civil Rights Bill from 1870 to 1874, when he made his last appeal. The bill was not reported until after his death, and then Senator Frelinghuysen said, "Would that the author of the measure were here, to present and defend it. To our view it would have been becoming that he, who was in the forum the leader of the grandest victory of the 19th century in the Western Hemisphere, the victory of freedom over slavery, should have completed the work he so efficiently aided. But it was otherwise decreed." It passed the Senate, but was not voted on in the House. In February 1875, a new House bill, omitting schools and cemeteries, became a law. In 1883, the Supreme Court pronounced this law unconstitutional. Sumner passed before the effect of the new alignment of big business on the Southern situation was clear. He was taken ill in March 1874. At his deathbed stood three Negroes, Frederick Douglass, George T. Downing, and Sumner Warmly, together with distinguished senators and officials. Three times he said hoarsely and in a tone of earnest entreaty, "You must take care of the Civil Rights Bill. My bill. The Civil Rights Bill. Don't let it fail." This was his last public message. Frederick Douglass led his funeral procession, and colored soldiers guarded his body at the State House in Boston. So died, as Sherman said, the foremost man in the civil service of the United States. William Lloyd Garrison had written, "Your blood staining the floor of the Senate chamber was the blood of a martyr. Now it is given to you to wear a martyr's crown. This is no human, but divine triumph. This is not in the wisdom of man, but in the power of God." The dream of democracy died hard. The final ratification of the 15th Amendment brought a special message from President Grant, March 30, 1870, which has a curious historical significance. Such notification is unusual, but I deem a departure from the usual custom justifiable. A measure which makes at once 4 millions of people voters, who were heretofore declared by the highest tribunal in the land not citizens of the United States, nor eligible to become so, with the assertion that at the time of the Declaration of Independence, The opinion was fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race, regarded as an axiom in morals as well as in politics, that black men had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, is, indeed, a measure of grander importance than any other one act of the kind from the foundation of our free government to the present day. Blaine, who preeminently represented that northern plutocracy which was throttling democracy, still spoke with the voice of wisdom. The 15th article of amendment to the Constitution, now pending and about to be adopted, would confirm the colored man's elective franchise and add the right of holding office. One of the senators just admitted from Mississippi in advance of the ratification on the amendment, Hiram R. Revels, was a colored man of respectable character and intelligence. He sat in the seat which Jefferson Davis had wrathfully deserted to take up arms against the Republic and become the ruler of a hostile government. Poetic justice, historic revenge, personal retribution were all complete when Mr. Revels' name was called on the roll of the Senate. But his presence, while demonstrating the extent to which the assertion of equal rights had been carried, served to increase and stimulate the Southern resistance to the whole system of Republican Reconstruction. Those who anxiously had studied the political situation in the South could see how unequal the contest would be, and how soon the men who organized the rebellion would again wield the political power of their states, wield it lawfully if they could, but unlawfully if they must. Peaceably, if that would suffice, but violently, if violence, in their judgment, became necessary.